We are back on the Financial Survival Network. You're listening to Kerry Lutz, and it's a great day today in sunny South Florida. With us now, we've got James Corbett. You know him well of the Corbett Report. He also has picked up the International Forecaster, Bob Chapman's old newsletter. He's doing a bang-up job on that. And James, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me back. It's always a pleasure to be here. And just to clarify, I'm writing the lead editorial for the Forecaster, but it's actually being run by Bob's daughter. So it's right. Still in the family.
Right. Well, the editorial, man, that's why I always read the Forecaster. I mean, yeah, it's got a plethora of information, you know, page after page of info going on from all over the world. And I remember listening to Bob back in 2009, he was the first one, James, to say that we're in a global depression and we're going to stay in a global depression for many, many years. There's still very few, I mean, nobody in the mainstream will say that we're in a global depression, but the alternative guys like you and I, you know, have said it. And if you look at unemployment in the U.S. and in the Western world, it's quite obvious that we're in a depression, right?
Well, I think that there are a number of indicators below the surface that show that we are definitely in some dire financial straits. And the entire surface reality is being propped up by just some illusory numbers. And just I'd like to direct your listeners to a new report from the OMFIF, which is really a banker think tank insider organization. So this is not exactly a wild conspiracy theorist organization. They're at OMFIF.com. They just released a detailed report looking at over 400 public sector institutions in 162 countries, and they discovered $29 trillion worth of investments in equities that are basically propping up assets and potentially overheating equities markets. Surprise, surprise. And as we see S&P and Dow Jones hitting record highs seemingly every single day, despite the fact of the continuing lackluster productive economy, it's pretty obvious what's going on. Basically, central banks are furiously pumping money into the directly into stocks now, just buying them outright, with $29 trillion worth of investments propping up a market that most investors, mom and pop investors out there, don't want to be in. And in fact, we keep getting indications that less and less people actually are the sort of average mom and pop investors actually hold stocks. And yet the stocks continue to be skyrocketing. And this is kind of one of those missing pieces of the puzzle. So it's an interesting little report that your listeners might want to check out.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about that. And it follows a thesis that we've been propounding, James, for literally the past, I don't know, since we've been doing the Financial Survival Network, which is that every market on the planet is rigged. And as if you needed more proof, right? LIBOR, we got foreign exchange, FX rigging. We've got bond markets, of course, because the bond markets QE is a form of rigging. And the ultimate rigging is central bank rigging through interest rates. So if you needed any more proof that every market on the planet is rigged, there's your proof, right?
And don't forget the London gold fix the cover is starting to be blown off of that. And there's even an investigation that's starting to charge people in the UK over some gold fix fixing that's going on. But I think they're just throwing some underlings under the bus. But at the very least, it's starting to be covered even in the mainstream. So it really is becoming just mainstream, mundane fact. Every single market is rigged, exactly as you say.
Yeah. And hey, don't forget, the silver fix is going away on August 14th. Kitco, interestingly enough, and we've mentioned this a number of times on the show, is trying to come up with their own little silver fix. And I assume when the gold fix goes away, which is going to happen because Deutsche Bank is going to withdraw from that as well, then Kitco is going to come up with their own little gold fix. But who is Kitco? It's an obscure, well, perhaps not that obscure, website in Montreal, Canada, by a guy named Kit, who has been running this site for many years, but they don't really have the credibility or the bones to replace a 117-year-old institution whose name is The Fix, right? So The Fix is out, right?
And it was literally run out of the Rothschild offices there in London for the first 80 years of its existence or so.
Yeah, so The Fix is unraveling in all these markets, I guess, is really the point, right?
Well, yes, and thankfully so, I want to say, because it can't but be a good thing for people to start to realize and to understand that there literally is fixing that goes on in the markets every single day. But I just worry about what's the next institution that's going to take it over and whether it will be even worse. And maybe that's just my pessimism coming through, but we'll have to obviously watch how that develops.
Yeah, well, you know, all these fixes and all these markets, they can't exist without confidence of the vast number of people, as well as government too, you know, the consent of the governed. And all of this confidence is unraveling, and it will reach a point, I think, where the confidence just ceases to exist. And like you say, what comes next after that? And I don't really think anybody can say. I don't think anybody knows what the next thing to go will be, but it's not going to be pleasant, that's for sure, at least in the short term. Intermediate term.
Well, yes. Yeah. It never works out for the little guy at the bottom. And just another example of that, there's a new study recently came out from the EPI talking about inequality, income inequality, talking about the 2009 to 2011 recovery, or so it's framed in the media, after the 2008 financial crisis. The top 1% earning an extra 11.5% income growth, and the bottom 99% losing 0.7%. And that's even with some fixed numbers themselves. So it always is skewed, again, towards the very top. And again, I think that's no accident. There are people in positions of power with wealth and influence who are going to use their wealth and influence to further consolidate their wealth and influence. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's just a basic sociological fact. And until people really wrap their minds around that and what it really means, as we see this, the people in positions of power going more and more out of control, I think they, we'll all suffer until people really wake up to what that really means and start building up an alternative financial infrastructure from the ground up, which again is not a small thing at all, but it's going to have to happen either through force or through voluntary cooperation. And I know which way I'd rather have it. And just another example of that, Zero Hedge has a story up on the front page right now talking about Greece basically going back to barter to try to settle wages. 2/3 of wages now in Greece being paid via barter. So if you don't have the alternative infrastructure in place when the collapse comes, it's going to basically resort back to the earliest stages of civilization. So I think we can do better than that, and that's why I hope people are starting to take a look at some of these alternative ideas before the feces hits the fan.
Yeah, like Bitcoin and precious metals, our old standby, been with us for 5,000 years. That's why we encourage you to go to our sponsor, Borderless Holdings. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, James, and it's not just because they're our sponsor, but we took them on specifically for this reason. They've got this wearable wealth, kind of a takeoff on the Indian thing, because all Indian jewelry is 22 karat jewelry. You know, it's really just investment jewelry. What they've come up with is basically beads on a bracelet or a necklace. It could be up to 10 ounces in weight, if you could believe it. I think you'd be stooped over wearing 10 ounces of gold. But these beads are 24 karat gold. They're detachable off of a sterling silver wire. I mean, it's really cool. And, you know, you need funds. You need to barter for something. You pass effortlessly over through borders of countries. There's no tariffs, no duties paid on this jewelry. And the Indians have had it right for hundreds of years. And this is the type of thing you need to be doing, right?
It's an ingenious little idea. And it also comes in handy for my rap video that I'm going to film someday. So there you go.
Hey, so you've been concentrating on pipelines lately. And there's a lot going on with them, isn't there?
There is so much going on, and it happens so quickly, and there's so many moving targets that are happening right now. But yes, I was keeping my eye closely on the Russia-China deal, obviously, that got signed last month. And that was a huge one, I think, in terms of just starting the turning of the tide in what could be, I think, the real formation of a resistance bloc to sort of the American led sort of NATO hegemony of the Central Asian region and that part of the global chessboard. I really see the Russia-China gas deal that was signed last month as the start of that, in a symbolic way, if nothing else. And very few of the details of that that deal have really leaked out. All we know is that the deal is going to be for a pipeline that's scheduled to be online by 2018, and it's going to the over the length of the deal, it's been estimated at $400 billion contract. So it's not an insignificant amount of change. It's not exactly going to be the largest portion of China's gas imports or the largest portion of Russia's exports, but it's pretty significant that these two nations are now cooperating and are finally putting a pipeline in place, which, I mean, only makes sense for the world's largest gas exporter on the border of the world's largest gas importer. I mean, it's only basic economic sense that this is happening. And it's only the sort of political tensions that have existed between China and Russia in the past that have prevented that from happening. And those tensions dissolve pretty quickly when there's other geopolitical events to bring this into focus. And of course, what's happening in Ukraine right now is definitely bringing Russia's attention to its western flank and to what it's going to have to do in order to diversify, as anyone in any financial situation has to do. You have to diversify so you don't have all your eggs in one basket. And I think Russia is realizing that. So not only have they just signed this deal with China, but now they're looking at running a pipeline down to South Korea. There's even been talks of pipelines to Japan. I think that some of these ideas are a bit pie in the sky, but at any rate, it does show that there are some moving pieces on this geopolitical chessboard that are kind of coming into focus because of the big conflicts we're seeing. And I think we're going to start seeing more and more of the geopolitical relations between countries, especially in Central Asia, East Asia, in that region, are going to start forming around these pipelines. I think pipelines are really the key to understanding and discerning the alliances that are going to be taking shape in the future, because these become, of course, the sort of hardwired relations between these countries. And once the billions of dollars have been invested in the infrastructure for these pipelines, it becomes a very real link between these nations and something that needs to be protected by both sides. So I think we're going to start seeing some pretty big moves happening in the near future along these types of pipelines that are developing.
Yeah, I think the handwriting is on the wall. And when we return, let's talk about what's going on with these new alignments, because the age of the Anglo-American power bloc hegemony is clearly coming to an end on the Financial Survival Network.
FSN Radio.
We're back with James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and we're talking about what's coming up in the future of alignments, realignment of nations. And like you said, James, these things can happen really quickly. And just like nobody saw the financial crisis of 2008 and its emergence effectively changing the power blocks, you know, who knows what's going to emerge in the future. We really could have the end of these ultra powerful nation states. Bob Hoy, I think you've spoken with him before. He believes that this is the end of the third authoritarian age of authoritarianism, where you have an age of prosperity and then you have all these bureaucrats step in and run things, and they're so inefficient they basically wind up confiscating everyone's wealth. And then people get sick of this, and the bureaucrats bankrupt everything. And we go back to decentralized government, and maybe that's an option here. Maybe that's really where we're heading, you know?
I think that there are contrary tendencies that are taking shape right now, and one of them is towards regional sort of groupings like the European Union. But we see what's happening with that financially in terms of this having this one monetary policy for the whole Eurozone, despite the fact that there are vastly different economies within it. And we see the way that that's really, I mean, strained to the point where now they've got the negative interest rates, and they're doing anything they can to try to stimulate the European economy, and nothing's working. Surprise, surprise. So I think that there's that tendency, but that's being counteracted by an independence tendency that's taking place in places like Catalonia. In Scotland, of course, has their independence referendum coming up later this year. And I think that this is, interestingly enough, I think it's almost a related phenomenon, because I think in both cases, these are movements that are, to a large extent, either being pioneered and pushed by, or at the very least have the potential to be used by the sort of multinational corporate financial infrastructure, which is really, I think, superseding the authority of the nation states. And of course, that comes to a head in organizations like the World Trade Organization, where, of course, countries basically sue each other and corporations sue countries and vice versa in this game to try to see who can one-up each other in terms of getting their nation's multinational corporations ahead of each other. But what does that really mean at the end of the day when some of these corporations are larger than many of the world's economies? It's a very strange time that we're living in. And I think we're seeing that macrocosm enacted in the microcosm in some of these pipeline projects. For example, of course, the South Stream pipeline, which is a pretty ambitious project. It's scheduled to be online by 2018 and is going to be supposedly pumping through 63 billion cubic meters of gas per year. And it's going to transit out from Russia across the Black Sea into Bulgaria and then up through either Greece, Serbia, Hungary, Slovenia, eventually ending up in Italy. And it's again, it's a pretty amazingly ambitious project, and it's been estimated anywhere up to 25 billion euros in terms of construction costs. But of course, we've been seeing some of the political angling that's coming to the fore now with the Anglo-American European backed Nabucco rival. And that power block is trying to block the construction of South Stream, and they're pulling out all the stops. And now, Russia is basically having to do some emergency diplomacy with Serbia to see if they can get the transit rights through Serbia and make sure that construction goes ahead as scheduled. And it's a very interesting game to be watching playing out right now. And of course, part of that is taking place in the WTO, where Russia has sued the European Union, which put in some regulations in 2009 that said that that gas suppliers can't own transit facilities like pipelines, which would mean Gazprom, which obviously wants to control South Stream, would have to allow third-party suppliers to use those pipelines, and they don't want that at all. So they're trying to go the WTO route to see if they can get that overturned. So again, a lot of back and forth that's going on right now, and all of those wranglings can be seen very explicitly in what's happening in Ukraine right now. And just a developing story right now, so I'm just following it. I don't have all of the details, but there has been an explosion in one of the pipelines in Ukraine, Pomery-Uzhgorod pipeline, which, according to different sources, I've been told that this is not a pipeline that is necessary for supplying Europe. And I've been told that it didn't actually disrupt any flows to Europe. And then I've heard other reports that said otherwise. So again, I'm trying to track down exactly what this pipeline does in terms of the transit it provides. But at any rate, there has been an explosion on it. And the latest is that sabotage is suspected. So now the question is, who is blowing up this pipeline and for what purpose? It doesn't seem like it's a main artery pipeline at any rate. So this could be just a warning, sort of a, hey, we can do this type of warning, but then who would be doing it? And the suspicion has to fall on the Ukrainian government, which has just had its gas cut off by Russia for failure to pay $2 billion of the $4.5 billion in back payments that it owes to Gazprom. So we see this back and forth. We now see an explosion along the pipeline, and this, I think, is going to be the type of story we're going to be seeing a lot more in the news in the coming years. And in fact, we've been watching this happening in Central Asia and in the Caucasus region for years past, with a lot of Islamic militancy cropping up around some of these pipelines in a lot of the Central Asian republics. And we've seen that sort of simmering under the surface for several years now. But I think, again, that's going to come to a head in the near future. And there's an entire story, a backstory about the Islamic militants that are popping up in Central Asia and NATO sponsorship of these, as talked about by FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds, and the fact that basically these Islamic militants are, just like in Syria and now in Iraq with ISIS, are being used as sort of a tool of Western interventionist policy to try to destabilize some of these countries to make sure that they side with the right side when it comes to these pipeline disputes. So again, I think you can see a lot of the different geopolitical relations that are coming into view by looking at the pipelines and what's happening along them, and even the physical integrity of these pipelines, which is becoming more and more important as again, a lot of these pipelines get laid in and start to form the geopolitical relations of the 21st century.
Hey, and these pipelines are really sitting ducks too, aren't they? They've got a lot of infrastructure, a lot of pumping stations, processing for natural gas. They've got processing compressor stations. And it's pretty easy to just take them out periodically just to send that message to the powers that be, right?
It is a nightmare to think about trying to secure all these just untold miles and miles and miles of pipeline and as you say, all these pumping stations and all of these things that again, come together. And every single point along these lines are vulnerable. And where do you try to secure or fortify them? And how do you do so? It's pretty much unimaginable. So you're exactly right. These are sitting ducks, and that leads to some potentially huge problems. And in the future, I mean, depending what pipelines are targeted and in what way and by whom and at what times, could lead to massive disruptions in terms of energy supply. For example, energy supply to Europe. And again, these pipelines can be geopolitical tools for the suppliers like Russia, who can decide to turn off the tap when they need to, and in order to make whatever point they want. And again, that puts Europe in quite a position. So it's interesting to see some of the European cohesion coming apart at the seams, or at least the idea of European cohesion come apart when some of these countries that stand to benefit from these pipelines transiting along them suddenly have a very, very different interest in seeing some of these pipelines created than, for example, in Brussels, where they obviously don't want some of these pipelines to be laid and for Russia to gain even more of a foothold in Europe. So again, it's just fascinating to watch some of these relations. And I'm, in fact, going to be writing specifically about this topic in the upcoming Forecaster editorial. So I'll go into some more depth about what's happening in Ukraine right now and see how that plays out in the region generally.
All right. Well, James, always a pleasure speaking with you. And I know, you know, the time difference often makes it hard for us to connect. Just tell us where we connect with you online and how we read your work.
CorbettReport.com is the one-stop shop for all of my work, CorbettReport.com. And from there, you can find links to all of my other websites and partner websites and all of the things I do. For the International Forecaster specifically, people can go to The International Forecaster. That's Forecaster. TheInternationalForecaster.com, and you can see many of my editorials are put up there, and you can also subscribe with a free introductory copy if it's your first time subscribing.
Excellent, and you'll find the link in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com, and don't forget to subscribe to our free newsletter. James, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.